Poetry on the Radio, poetry in and around the ACT. Today, we speak with Barkindji artist and poet Barina South. I'm Kimberly K. Williams. Barina South is a Barkindji artist and poet who writes about land, culture, and history. She is a current member of the First Nations Australia Writers Network and a director of Us Mob Writing. In 2023, she was awarded a Varuna First Nations Fellowship, and her work appeared in the online journals Authora Australis and a special issue of the Tista Review, a journal of poetry in Kolkata, India. In 2022, Barina South was published in the journal Rabbit and was appointed writer-in-residence at University of Canberra, and she was one of five Australian poets selected to participate in Invisible Walls, Poetry is a Doorway to Intercultural Understanding, a partnership between the University of South Australia and Sogong University in Seoul. She has appeared in two anthologies published by the ACT region Us Mob Writers Group, Too Deadly, Our Voice, Our Way of Business, and the recent Karaka. Peter Monahan and I spoke to Barina South in December 2023. I wondered maybe if you could just start by talking about what brought you to poetry.
But first of all, I just want to say Nyai, Barkindji Wimpincha. I'm a Barkindji woman living on Ngambri Ngunnawal country, and I just want to pay my respects to the traditional owners of the land that we're meeting on this morning. What brought me to poetry? I think I've always had the tendency to see the world through a poet's eyes. I don't think there was any particular time in my life where I thought, oh, I'm now a poet. I think it's something that's just, the space around it has allowed it to come out. My undergraduate degree was in visual arts, so I was a practicing visual artist for a number of years. I moved to a small flat in Sydney, and the space constraints didn't allow me to do big oil paintings in the rental studio in Sydney. And that's when I diverted my creativity to creative writing. And I tried to, instead of painting what I saw and what influenced me and what I wanted to express, it then came through in written word.
I wonder where you find the overlaps between painting and poetry.
Well, I think the overlaps is being able to see the world a bit differently and be able to actually look and spend that time considering and looking deeply at your surrounds. Mm-hmm. And I think that helps to then to write about what you're looking at, rather than, you know, green leaves on a tree. You know, you're looking deeper, and I think that visual perspective comes through in my poetry. Mm-hmm. A lot of people say I'm able to create imagery effectively, and when I read it out loud, that people can actually imagine and see the imagery that I'm trying to portray.
There's also a lot of use of color in your poems.
There is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And short stories as well.
Oh, you write short stories.
Yeah, I write short stories. And I'm working on a play.
Oh, wow.
I think coming from a visual arts background, I think that also helps with playwriting as well. Being able to set the scene, being able to visually see how things will work with each other on stage. Mm.
So almost in a way, spatial relations.
Yes.
Yeah. Wow. So you also write art reviews.
Yes. Last year, I was approached by Canberra City News to be an arts reviewer, and I've been doing that for a year now under the guidance of Helen Musa, who's been really fantastic. She's been in the field for quite a long time, and she's been very generous in guiding me and making me become a better critic, which is great. And also write for Arts Hub as well, both visual arts reviews and book reviews.
Mm. In terms of your poetry, if the listener wanted to go about finding some of your poems, where would they look?
So I've been published in a number of online journals. Mm-hmm. So one is Eora Australis. Mm-hmm. I've got a poem there. I've got a few poems in two online journals in India, journals. But apart from that, I have some poetry in two anthologies that the local Us Mob Writers group, First Nations Writers group, have published. One is Too Deadly, Our Voice, Our Way of Business. And we've just released a new collection called Karaka. And that was in honour of Auntie Kerry Reid Gilbert, a very staunch and active First Nations poet here in Canberra, who was part of the writers group and who was successful in securing funding to do the anthology. Unfortunately, she passed away before the anthology was published, so it's in honour of her.
Mm.
And Karaka is a Wiradjuri word for the sulphur-crested cockatoo.
Oh, that's neat. The book is beautiful just visually with the cover, the pastels, and then the poems in it. In your section, mm-hmm. each poet's given a section yeah. in this book. It starts with a quotation, "Creativity is the difference between a leader and a follower." Mm-hmm. And I wondered if you could speak to that a little bit more.
I think in the role of being a leader, you have to be creative in terms of thinking outside the box, looking at how to lead your team differently to their needs. There's no one size fits all, and so you need to be creative in understanding the group that you're working with. I've been a public servant for about 25 years now. So with your teams, you need to consider each of your staff, their strengths and their weaknesses, and be creative in how you can bring them along to become better people in the workforce.
Mm.
And that requires creativity. You can't learn that. You need something that comes from within.
I saw a quote from you that speaks to that. When I write a poem, it is always to a secret addressee, and I am delighted when they find each other.
Yes, I am. Mm.
Well, you're thinking about that consciously. Mm. Why? What's the goal?
Well, obviously, when you're creating an artwork or a poem, there's obviously something or someone that's sparked that in you. So I'm always looking, and I'm different to other writers where I don't have a notebook. I keep everything filed in my mind. And so whatever I see, I file it away. And then when I meet someone, I sort of go through that file in my mind and I write with somebody in mind. And a lot of the time people do pick up that the poem is something to do with them or influenced by them. Mm-hmm. And I take great joy in that because, I don't know, I quite like that little secrecy of like writing something and hoping that the reader will discover it and find it like a precious little gem.
Right, mm-hmm. Yeah, secret missive.
Yeah.
You also mentioned the analytic aspect of what you do, and I think you started in on some academic studies, advanced studies. So you bring that analysis also, it would seem. So you have the organic, the analytic, the personal, speaking to an addressee and so forth. But the analytic does seem important to you.
Mm. Yeah, so I completed undergraduate in visual arts, done postgraduate and did my master's honours in sociology. And I started a PhD in history at ANU. Which I got halfway through and nearly finished, but my son was quite young at the time and he'd always try and put things under the door or try and get my attention, knock on the door and say, "Mummy, you know, what are you doing in there?" And it was okay when he was littler, but when he got a bit older, it sort of got a bit harder. And I remember one autumn, my husband and son were out in the garden and I was in the office typing away and I was thinking, this is not worth it. I'm going to close the laptop and I'm going to go outside. And then I had to tell my supervisor, I'm not doing my doctorate anymore. Mm.
Yeah. Really an intentional choice.
Yeah, it was difficult. I still struggle with that decision. I possibly will go back at another date, but I thoroughly enjoyed doing that research. And so that was touching on what I was writing as part of my master's was highlighting the important role of Aboriginal women's autobiographical narratives and that they're sort of dismissed or ignored as primary sources, important primary sources for uncovering previously subjugated knowledges and experiences that you don't find in any other avenues. And so around spirituality, gender themes, language, political movement, and I also recorded the oral history of Aunty June Barker and her life living on the Brewarrina mission, which is the same mission that my family are from.
What interesting connections.
You have these different sort of facets of your practice, and that analytic historical one, do you see yourself in a sense as, when you, for example, address those undersung voices, are you on a mission in a sense? So speak to issues and knowledge that is yours and not commonly shared in Australia.
Yeah, there is that. I always try and bring that to my writing, making sure that it's a great avenue to do some truth-telling and to impart our experience and our history of living in this state of New South Wales as First Nations people. I think poetry is a really great way of doing that. Or even short stories. I write short stories as well. Because you've actually got the opportunity to have a one-on-one with somebody who's, you know, made a conscious decision to read your work, and that you can really impart what you want to them in a way that's really effective, probably more so than visual arts. People see a piece and they remember it and have that reaction, and then they move, unless they buy the work, which is great. But with a book, you know, people are sitting down, it's a private exchange, and people normally hang on to books. Well, I certainly do.
Mm-hmm.
And they revisit books at different times of their lives. I think that's where writing is a powerful tool.
As some of the ways that you write, do they relate to those, I guess, histories that you learn from women? Yeah. I noticed, for example, that you don't always write in what might be considered a grammatical English.
Well, I never studied poetry, so poetry just happened.
Mm.
So I don't know the rules of poetry, which is kind of good in a way, because I don't know what I should be doing and what I shouldn't be doing. I did a stay at Varuna Writers' House in Katoomba, and when I was at that, there was a lot of other poets there, and they were all talking about, like, Sestinas and Duplex. I think it's Duplex, or I don't know. Lots of different terms around poetry and writing that I had no really idea what they were referring to. And then I thought, oh, I think I need to know all about this. So I did a few short courses with Writing New South Wales to just know the language around writing. So I haven't studied poetry or writing, so I just write, just write.
Well, yeah, and I actually meant the question as praise of your writing, not as to suggest there's any shortcoming, because it's imagistic in some ways, when it's not grammatical, it's expressively not grammatical. So there's phrases that you use. You also use a language that I presume is Bakinji language.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is it's very moving.
It adds a texture, I think, that a lot of poems don't have. That I think you don't maybe know you're missing it until you read poems like your poems, and it's there and you feel it. And you think, oh, there's a depth here. And I believe that poets, most writers, but poets in particular, write out of an impulse. And you definitely seem to write out of the impulse. But what interests me listening to you talk is that you also really think about the reader.
Yes, I do. I definitely think of the reader. I find that if someone's going to take the time to read your work or come and see you read, you must give them 100% and definitely an experience. I don't write for me. I mean, I have to write because it builds up to a point where I have to write, but I'm always thinking of the audience, because there's nothing worse when you go to a poetry reading and you shouldn't say stuck there, but you're there and it's dry and they go on and it's like seven stanzas, and they're just talking about things and you're not feeling anything. And some people, I think, with reading, they kind of think about themselves. They love hearing their own voice. And as an audience member, you're like, Oh, I just can't wait to get out of
here. Yeah, you just check out. Yeah.
So I don't ever want anyone who's taken the time to come and read my work or hear me read to ever feel like that.
I love that. Would you read a couple of poems so we can hear you read? That's a great segue.
Okay.
We asked her to read some of her poems, beginning with one published in Rabbit.
This is an example of where I want the reader or the audience to feel something, to walk away and not forget the poem. This poem's called A Few of My Favourite Things. Dip my arms into hot wax, smash my shin with a hammer, tie my long hair to the rafter, drop down and swing. Scrape off the rust with my teeth, hold a lit match on my eye and an ice cube on the other, eat a tablespoon of flour, drink a cup of vinegar, lick a handful of salt with a cut tongue and ulcered mouth, insert a long sharp needle in my ear, hit the other hard with a paddle, open cheeks with a razor and insert hot coals. Kick the little small toe against the bed leg. Slowly peel back your fingernails. Wrap your thighs in barbed wire and run. These are a few of my favorite things.
When you read, you savor each syllable. Mm. I love that. So would you talk about why you love this poem so much?
I love this poem so much because I wanted to write something to make people feel something, feel the words and feel what I wanted to say.
The discomfort.
The discomfort. And I was just thinking of all the things. It actually came from a poetry slam poem that I'd written, where I'd got on stage and I was kind of new to reading, and I was talking about, you know, all the things that I would have preferred to be doing, and here I was on stage. I didn't really want to read this poem in front of it, and I wanted to get a reaction from the audience to get the clicks going, and so I used some of these sentences in that. And when I, especially this last one, wrap your thighs in barbed wire and run, everyone was clicking. So that was really good. But there's also another sort of undertone to this, and I won't go into that. But
you sure?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but the main idea of this poem was to make people feel things, and I was thinking of all the things that would make people shudder.
It's such a clever mix, because some of the things, you know, like light your eye on fire, right? Mm. You're probably apt not to do, but then you weave in things like smashing your toe against the bedside. I mean, how many times have I done that?
Mm.
Right? And so it's an interesting way of navigating the imagination, where you're, it's both completely experiential and then completely imaginative, and you're weaving it in such a way you can't anticipate. Yeah. And I think that increases the discomfort.
Mm. So I do try to, in that poem, talk about trauma and about pain, and talk about, you know, I wasn't going to talk about it, but it was sort of like an undertone of being, you know, a First Nations person living in this place now called Australia. And I just didn't want to go down the path of some of the more commonly referred, you know, wording around what's it like to be dispossessed and the effects of colonization. And I guess, you know, obviously I didn't write that, you know, the other day, but, you know, with The Voice, for Yes, The Vote for Yes, it's like every day as First Nations people, there's something that hurts you.
Yeah.
Something that comes, and it can be like a microaggression of, oh, you don't look Aboriginal, or you're not black enough, or, you know, there's the drunks over there, or why should we give money to Aboriginal people? They're just going to destroy their homes, or, you know, why should I vote yes? So there is little chipping away of trauma, of hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's another sort of undercurrent of that poem as well.
The layer upon layer.
Mm.
And it probably comes at you in unexpected ways, even though maybe once it arrives, it feels familiar.
Mm.
And so I could see that.
Yeah, but also the main purpose was to make people feel something.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Most people do.
Mm. There's a poem you had that when you were saying that, it made me think, the ghost gum.
Yeah.
Where it starts and you're not sure. If this is a kind of a domestic abuse, if this is a, you know, what is being harmed here?
So this came out of a workshop. You can see it's quite a few years ago now. It came out of a workshop I did with a vet, Holt, who's a First Nation poet. She came to Canberra and did a workshop with our Mob Writers group, and one of the tasks was she gave us photos of the ghost gums from Central Australia, and we were to write about the tree. During the workshop, I'm a writer that I just can't just write it all out. I have to think about it and write it and then edit it and write it. And, you know, some people can just write it all out in one go. So I actually had to take the photo away and really look at it and then write the piece. So the tree that I got was really bruised and gnarled, and there was sap coming out of it, and it was beaten. It looked like it had been beaten, but from the elements. So that's where I was writing from. However, people have said it sounds like it's somebody being beaten. Yeah, and I think it may be the sort of the scientific sort of words that I've got in, like lesions and hemorrhaging, which leads people to that idea. I wanted to make sure that at the end of that poem that there's a bit of a shift, and it's about the tree herself being happy and in a place of safety as she gently sways and is safe at the end. So just to make sure that people didn't think that, you know, the tree was still in pain. I'll read it. It's called Ghost Gum. And it's in the Two Deadly Anthology. Ghost Gum. Upon the once young, creamy, pink-tinged skin, pooled blood appears on the surface, caused by previous contusions, leaving her discolored. Recent lesions continue hemorrhaging, old sores still weeping, the disfigured and swollen skin now tight, shiny, ready to split. Her veins draw the healing sap to the surface to medicate all wounds. Seasonally white, powdery bark scales are shed, stolen by the hot wind. Saucer-like seeds fall out of wide open woody mouths of those who sing as they regurgitate the beginning of another. In the cool of the night respite, she reaches up, gently sways, dancing in time with the stars as they sweep across the desert night sky.
I lived in the desert US for about 20 years. So that final image, every time, I just have a skin, like a goosebump reaction.
Yeah, so that's why I wanted to end it with that. So she'd been through that, the tree has been through that, for whatever reason, but at the end of the night, that cool breeze, and she just keeps swaying.
Yeah.
You know, the strength of women.
That's right. And I think that poem also shows your use of color, your use of shape and texture in it as well.
Mm.
Bruni, you mentioned the Us Mob Writing Group.
Mm.
Most people won't know what that is. Can you explain what it is and who's in it and, you know, where it exists?
The Us Mob Writing Group is a writers group for First Nations writers, Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander writers. It just happens to be all women, but that's not on purpose. We did have a few males join the group, so it's not exclusively female, but we welcome anyone. So it's primarily a writers group to support Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander writers in the ACT and surrounds.
Mm.
I'm the surround because I live in Queanbeyan. Everybody else lives in the ACT. But it's a writers group that we get together monthly, and we just talk about our writing practice, where we want to take the writers group, you know, seeking funding so people can attend various festivals. We sometimes have writing tasks where somebody will come up with a word. We have 2 weeks to write something and send that in, just a bit of, just to keep people writing. Mm-hmm. From those various tasks, you know, we look at future publications. So as I mentioned, we've just brought Karaka out. That's based on some of the work from these workshops with, like, Yvette Holt, Melissa Lashenko, Ellen Van Neven, who come and do workshops with us, but also our writing tasks as well, and put together an anthology. We're also looking at doing chapbooks, where we're going to pair with another writer in the group to come up with some chapbooks. What works well with this writers group, because I was also part of the Queanbeyan writers group as well, what works well with the Us Mob writers group is that we don't critique each other's work. And I think that's the strength of the writers group. So everybody's on their own path, and we just merge every month, just check in, touch base, see where we want to go, what people are up to, and then everybody goes on their own path. When I was in the Queanbeyan writers group, we did critique work, and I think you have to be a strong person to accept critique from your peers, and not everybody in the group was at that level of accepting feedback, and that sort of didn't make for a very successful group. So I think that's what makes this group so good, is that we don't critique each other's work. Everybody is allowed to just do what they want to do.
Sometimes it seems important for writers to simply hold space for each other, and it sounds like that's what Us Mob does. You have 2 anthologies. Are there more?
There was another one. It was Close of Business, but I just started with the group at that time. And I wasn't confident to have my work published in the anthology. So I had the opportunity to submit something, but I didn't at the time.
Something that arises from that group, you talked about it a bit early on, it's the idea of heritage and inheritance. You talked about, in a sense, inheriting women's stories. That's clearly very important. It provides a freshness to your poetry that's really underscored by your use of language. But that's presumably the way you think. It's not an exoticism, it's the way you think.
That's right. Yeah, so everything I write is 100% what I feel and think and see and want to put down on paper. And I, as mentioned before, I haven't studied poetry, so I'm not sure what you call it, but it's just how I write.
But you use Barkindji language. And in a sense, you'd say, well, we're in Australia, why not? That's, in, if anything, that makes more sense than not using it.
Yeah, I don't use it all the time. I'm very careful when because I don't want to saturate, you know, the poetry just for the sake of putting the words in there. I only very rarely put words in, and it's only when I really feel like there's a need for words, because it's not also, as I mentioned before, I write for myself and for the reader, so I try to use words that allows the reader to understand what I'm saying, that it doesn't alienate them, but brings them on that journey. So that's why I use certain words at certain times.
On next week's episode of Poetry on the Radio, we'll continue our conversation with Barina South and also share some thoughts on reaching the first anniversary of broadcasting Poetry on the Radio. I'm Kimberly K. Williams.
Poetry on the Radio is produced weekly on unceded traditional land in the studios of ArtSound FM and airs Sundays at 4:30 p.m. and again at 10:30 p.m. on Mondays and online at artsound.fm. Series hosts are Kimberly K. Williams and Peter Searles, who produced the program with me, Peter Monahan. Our theme is an imagining of an ancient Greek hymn to the muse Calliope by Gregoria Paniagua and the Atrium Musica de Madrid.